This podcast is brought to you by the American Enterprise Institute.
If you like what you hear, please subscribe, rate, review, and share.
Thanks for listening. Here's our show.
What in the hell's going on?
What the hell is going on?
What the hell is going on?
I don't know what the hell he's talking about.
You don't have to know what the hell is on it.
What the hell's the matter with these guys?
We don't know what's going on.
What the hell's going on?
Who in God's name knows what it's all about?
Hi, I'm Danielle Pletka.
And I'm Mark Thiessen.
Welcome to our podcast, What the Hell is Going On? Mark, what the hell is going on this week?
Well, what we're talking about today is what the hell's going on at the UN with the United States and Israel. So the Security Council just passed a resolution calling for a ceasefire and in Gaza, and the administration, the Biden administration, abstained, which means they basically supported it. You know, because the U.S. has a veto in the Security Council, and we use it on a regular basis to knock down these anti-Israel resolutions, which have been coming, you know, in hot and heavy long before October 7th and this war began. I think Israel is the most condemned country in the entire United Nations, despite the membership of Cuba and Syria and Russia and China and everybody else. But for some reason, Israel is always the target at the UN. And the one country that always protects Israel is the United States. And they let this happen. What the hell, Danny?
Well, you know, as our guest said, it's not so much that the United States abstained. The United States actually allowed this to happen, because anything that happens in the Security Council that happens affirmatively happens because one of the permanent five members of the Security Council does not exercise their right to veto it. And that's exactly what happened inside the Biden administration.
Just like Russia just defeated a resolution condemning Hamas as a terrorist organization by vetoing it.
Exactly. Well, the Hamas leadership was not too long ago in Moscow visiting with their friend Vladimir to talk about this. This is what's
But these are completely unconnected, by the way, Russia and Hamas. Yes.
Oh,
and Ukraine and all the rest of it. Yes.
Right. I mean, Hamas, which embraced the same tactics and stems and grows from the same ideology as ISIS, and ISIS just committed a devastating attack on the outskirts of Moscow against innocent Russian civilians. But now
that was Ukraine, Danny.
Sorry. Forgive me for not listening to Kremlin propaganda. But look, what I want to talk to you about in the short intro that we have, we talk a lot about what's going on in Israel. We talk a lot about the UN resolution. I want to talk for a second about what has happened inside the Biden administration. You and I have, throughout our discussions since October 7th, given credit to Joe Biden for being the sort of beating heart and soul of a pro-Israel slant inside this administration. So if our listeners remember, and they know, as we know all too well in Washington, the Biden administration is the Obama administration with a different person at the top. All the officials are the same. All the senior leaders are the same. All the apparatchiks are the same. And the Obama administration was the most hostile to the state of Israel since the creation of the state of Israel in 1948. Okay, absolutely. Obama not only can't stand Bibi Netanyahu, he has no sympathy whatsoever for Israelis and frankly represents that very extreme left wing of the Democratic Party. Those are the guys inside this administration, but Joe Biden held the line because he was always, you know, like our late great friend Joe Lieberman, part of the pro-Israel center of the Democratic Party. That is now over. Okay, that period has ended. And what I still, I guess I don't want to understand, maybe I understand it, is how those left-wing nuts got a hold of the steering wheel inside this administration. Is it just Michigan? What's going on?
Well, it is Michigan in the sense that Joe Biden thinks he can't win the presidency without Michigan, and 5%. It's Dearborn, Michigan has the largest Arab American population outside of the Middle East. And so they are terrified that those voters are going to abandon them and that they will lose Michigan and that this will elect Donald Trump. What they don't take into account is the fact that Michigan also has a large Jewish population, and Michigan has a large population of normal people who, the majority of whom, you know, support Israel. I mean, super majorities support Israel. And, you know, I talked about it with our guests, but there was a new Harvard-Harris poll. We just had Mark Penn on the pod, and he asked the most interesting questions. He found that 54% majority of Americans think that Joe Biden is making decisions in the Israel-Hamas war based primarily on his domestic political considerations, not on what's best in foreign policy for the United States, for Israel, for the world. You know, that is more damaging to him in Michigan and everywhere else than pandering to a bunch of, you know, pro-Hamas sympathizers who probably are never going to vote for him anyway because he's not going to abandon Israel. He's not going to do what they want. They don't care if he right. what the UN Security Council says. They want him to call it genocide and to cut off Israel and to cut off weapons and to lead the fight against this. And they're not going to be satisfied with anything he does. So it's just all he does is project political weakness. And weakness is devastating politically.
Right. No, no. I completely agree with you. I think, look, you know, I mean, if there's one theme of this podcast, day in, day out. Well, obviously not. But it's the dearth of leadership that we have at the heart of, frankly, both of our political parties. I do want to say, I want to raise something because, you know, we make no apology for who we are and what we believe, but there is other polling. Now, we had Mark Penn on, and for folks who are interested, go back and listen to him and hear why it is that he feels his answers are the highest quality. We all know, you know, depending on how you phrase the question, you're going to get different results. But I will say that Gallup gets very different results than Mark Penn, and we should not cherry pick 100%. The Gallup poll shows that from just March of this year, it shows that now 55% of Americans disapprove of Israel's actions, only 36% approve, and that approval has dropped 14 points since November. Now, again, I think there are some internal inconsistencies. I think Gallup asks these questions in a way that is unreasonably unfair, but there is not a strong consensus in the polling community that one side or the other is doing well. And I think part of that is the fact that there has been now this relentless turn inside this administration against Israel. They've tried to pretend that it's about Benjamin Netanyahu, but that's bullshit. Okay. It's not about Benjamin Netanyahu because Benjamin Netanyahu is not the sole decision maker in the Israeli National Unity Cabinet that is running the war in Gaza. You may hate Bibi for a whole bunch of different things, but none of those things have anything to do with the conduct of the war in Gaza. And that's the thing that I think people fail to perceive here. They think they can, you know, split Bibi off from the Israelis and therefore conduct this sort of, you know, political campaign against him and that it won't have an impact on attitudes towards Israel. It just doesn't work that way.
Well, first of all, this is why this Biden strategy is so self-destructive. So you're supporting Israel. You're giving them weapons. You understand that they're going to go into Rafah whether or not you want them to or not, and that the unity government there is united in the understanding that they have to destroy Hamas and that they're not going to stop until Hamas is destroyed. There's no political faction of any consequence in Israel that isn't united on that fact. So it's going to happen. And so when you go and let's say the Gallup numbers are correct or it's somewhere in between, that there, whatever, that there's some slippage in public support, well, that's because, in part, because the president of the United States keeps criticizing Israel for not caring about civilian casualties. And so when you say that over and over again, then people start to believe that Israel doesn't care about civilian casualties, when in fact, there's probably no country in human history that has taken more efforts to limit civilian casualties in a war than Israel has in this fight.
Yeah,
and it's Hamas that is hiding in the tunnels while they're forcing the civilians to stay above in the line of fire. And if the president was saying that on a regular basis, as opposed to criticizing Israel, then maybe the feelings would be different about that. So, you know, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Again, not in his political interest. If you're going to support Israel, as he does, then it's not in your political interest to convince people that Israel's the bad guy here.
Yeah, well, I think there's a lot of confusion at the top, if I may.
And by confusion, you don't mean ideological yes. confusion or moral confusion. You mean literally confusion.
Exactly.
What did I say last
week? Sadly, that's true. All right. Well, and with that very expected intervention, let's introduce our guest. I'm sure most of our listeners are familiar with Dan Senor, but this is his first time on the podcast. He is the host of a great podcast, highly recommended, called Call Me Back. He's the co-author of New York Times best-selling books, The Genius of Israel, The Surprising Resilience of a Divided Nation, and Startup Nation, The Story of Israel's Economic Miracle. Both fantastic, really interesting books. He's a former DOD official, was a senior advisor to former Speaker Paul Ryan's campaign for president. Dan's been around forever. I remember when he was a young guy on Capitol Hill working for Spence Abraham. So that's how long he's been around. He's a partner now at Elliott Investment Management.
Here's our interview. Dan, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, great to be with you. Longtime listener, first time guest. I've been listening to you guys for a while now, and so I'm thrilled to be on it. You have just the right mix of substance and wit and cynicism that I relate to. So I'm great to be on What the Hell.
Well, thank you. We appreciate it. We love your podcast as well. Speaking of which, you've been obviously talking a lot about Israel recently, and we just had this the first time, and you can tell me how long, that the U.S. abstained in the U.N. Security Council on a resolution that was critical of Israel. This seems to be a fairly historic break in the traditions of U.S. foreign policy. At a normal time, it would be terrible, but at a time when Israel has been attacked so brutally and is trying to defend itself and the world is starting to turn on Israel, you know, to get stabbed in the back. You tell me if you think that's an overstatement, but to be stabbed by the back by its strongest ally at this critical moment seems unprecedented and really disturbing.
Well, when I've been trying to explain it, I try not to use the word abstain, because abstain, in a sense, lets the administration off the hook a little bit. It sounds like it's a little more innocuous than it actually was. I explained that the U.S. greenlit the passage of this resolution, meaning the administration knew exactly what it was doing. It may have technically abstained, but it knew when it was abstaining that this was going to pass by 14-0 in the Security Council. So it effectively greenlit it, supported it, wanted it to pass. So there have been moments where there have been bad Security Council resolutions the U.S. has vetoed. There was one particular moment at the end of the Obama administration when a bad Security Council resolution against Israel that the U.S. did not stop, so that you can compare it to that. But I prefer not to compare what Biden did and what the administration did on this U.N. vote to other administrations. I just want to compare it to Biden. I want to compare Biden versus Biden, which is to say, as I've said many times on my own podcast and said to anybody who will listen, I do give the administration high marks for the first few months of their conduct during the October 7th war massacre, the last few months of hell. In that, I think President Biden spoke in terms in those early months that were, I think, undergirded by a real sense of moral clarity about who was good and who was evil and whose side the U.S. was on. I think that was very important. I think up until 2 weeks ago, the Biden administration had given Israel tremendous diplomatic cover, vetoing bad resolutions at the U.N., and then also deployed military assets to the region, which were important, and supplied Israel with extraordinary military resources to help Israel fight this war. So I really do give them high marks. I think at some point, the administration has become, I think, too influenced by political advisors worried about President Biden's reelection campaign. I don't think it's wise political strategy, but that being said, it's political strategy that I think is driving a lot of what they're doing now, and that sort of overtook the foreign policy objectives, and they needed to separate from Israel in some way. And so where it landed, Mark, is this two-pronged strategy that the administration seems to have, which is at the strategic level, they're still supporting Israel. In fact, we even just saw news of this arms transfer a few days ago. So they're still supplying Israel with what it needs to fight. I think they're basically going to not stand in the way of Israel going into Rafah. So they're doing all the right things still on the strategic level. That's one prong. And then the other prong is let's pick public fights with Israel's government, and specifically with Israel's prime minister, in the hope that we can score points at home with their political base, with their progressive base. And so the UN resolution was that. It was like, hey, watch us stick it to Israel. Oh, don't look over there. Don't look over here while we're supplying them with 2,000-pound bombs. Look over here how we're sticking it to them at the UN. And the problem with it, of course, is there's real implications for the latter. You can't have it both ways. You can't think you're supplying them with the arms and screwing them at the UN and that what they're doing at the UN won't have implications for Israel's ability to fight the war.
Dan, we're big fans of your podcast as well, and I'm so delighted that you're game to join us. One of the things that I want to underscore to people just before we leave this UN resolution issue, look, I don't think that Mark Thiessen and Danny Pletka's listeners are confused that we somehow think the United Nations and everything it does is really important, because we don't. And in fact, you know, we could do chapter and verse for hours on that. The more important thing, as you rightly say, is the decision-making inside the Biden administration. But I want to just talk about the substance for one sec, because for the first time in this Security Council resolution, we see a delinkage between a notion of a ceasefire and the release of the hostages. Would you just explain that to our listeners before we move on and talk about other bad things in the Biden administration?
That was the part of this that was most upsetting to me. I think the administration had been very consistent and very strong early on that not only were they not going to call on Israel to implement any kind of ceasefire, but that any ceasefire, any talk of ceasefire, would only get oxygen if it were conditioned on release of the hostages, full stop. The administration would often point to the importance of those two issues being linked when it would explain why it would veto previous resolutions. And then suddenly, they greenlit a resolution that delinks those two issues. So you are right, Danny. The resolution calls for release of the hostages and calls for a ceasefire, but as though they're on parallel tracks, as though one is not connected to the other. That, well, if you can get the ceasefire, but the hostages are still there, well, at least we're implementing part of the resolution, so let's get that done. That's the first time we've seen that kind of language, as opposed to saying we're not even going to entertain talk of a ceasefire. No country would be expected to engage in serious talk about a ceasefire while innocent men and women, their citizens, are being held in dungeons by terrorists in another territory. So the delinkage was alarming. And I got to tell you, the reason I found it so upsetting is I have generally found, and I hate to say this because, you know, I'm in touch with a lot of the families of the hostages, the interest in the plight of the hostages and their families is on the decline. I hope it doesn't endure. I hope that there's an uptick in engagement and interest and focus on them. But I've just been sensing generally that for the first few months, people were worried about it and people were paying attention. And now it's less and less so. And when you formally de-link the plight of the hostages from a talk of Israel ending the war, I think it's on a continuum. Look at Biden's State of the Union address. So at the State of the Union address, if I were president, if I were advising President Biden, I would have said, have families of the hostages in the gallery. And he didn't. There were family members of the hostages, the American Israeli Americans who were at the State of the Union, but they were invited by members of Congress from both parties. Lindsey Graham, Jackie Rosen, I mean, members from both parties invited family members of the hostages. And when the White House learned that, they put something in the speech about it. But they weren't planning to do it on their own. And so I just think generally they're losing interest, maybe too strong a word. I think the White House cares, but I just think there's a general decline. That's the first thing. The second thing I think that was incredibly problematic about the resolution is there was no mention of Hamas. In other words, it didn't say Israel's fighting a war against a terrorist organization, which, oh, by the way, is not an entity that's a member of this body. It is a rogue genocidal organization. That's who Israel's fighting this war against. And Israel did not start the war. The way the resolution reads, you would think that the world woke up one day and Israel and Hamas were in this war. There was just, oh yeah, there's this war going on and we should try to wind it down. As opposed to laying out, wait a minute, who's responsible for this war? How did it start? Who is a member of this body, a member of the UN, a Western-style democratic country? Who are they fighting against? There was no history. There was no context. There was no origin story of how we got here. And I think that also was reprehensible.
You're really depressing the hell out of me earlier.
Sorry.
Dan.
It's not all depressing. I mean, there's some good news.
There is. Because, you know, again, to overuse that now extremely hackneyed phrase, you know, what happens in the UN Security Council doesn't stay in the Security Council. So even if we say, okay, Security Council doesn't matter. Even if we say, yeah, precedent setting, but whatever, it's the UN, they hate the Jews. We have to accept two outcomes from this. One is that the ongoing dialogue that has been stewarded by the Qatari government, and I want to talk about that later in the podcast, but the ongoing negotiations that have been stewarded by the Qatari government with Hamas about a ceasefire, again, the terms of which have been repeatedly accepted by Israel, have been refused by Hamas since that Security Council resolution, number one. And number two, what you say about the hostages. You know, there were huge demonstrations just now in Israel on just this question. First of all, hostile to Bibi Netanyahu, which is something we should talk about as well, but about the fact that people feel like the hostages are being forgotten. Is there any way to get back from this point? Is there a ceasefire ahead? Is there any way of repairing any of this in your view?
So first of all, what is most frustrating to me, among the things that are most frustrating to me about this turn by the administration, is the confusing signal it sends to everybody. It sends a confusing signal to Israelis. It sends a confusing signal to Hamas. It sends a confusing signal to Iran and its proxies. It sends a confusing signal to our friends and allies in the region, like Saudi Arabia. So just take each one of these entities, right? The Saudis look at this and say, wait a minute. So you guys had Israel's back for the first few months, and then you effectively, at least at the UN, throw them under the bus, seemingly out of nowhere. For what? For domestic political needs? Like, I often ask, what changed? Like, Israel laid out its objectives, the war cabinet, which is not just Netanyahu, right? As you guys know, the war cabinet's Benny Gantz and Yoav Gallant and Gadi Eisenkot. I mean, it's a real cross-section of the Israeli political spectrum. The war cabinet laid out its objectives for this war very early on, and it's been pursuing those objectives with great effect, and it's been keeping the administration completely dialed in and up to date on what's happening and how they're waging this war, and the administration has been supportive. And then one day the administration says, no, we got to switch course. Like, why? What changed? Obviously, what changed was domestic U.S. politics. So if you're the Saudi leadership and you're contemplating getting into a deeper relationship with the United States in the context of some kind of normalization deal with Israel, you're sitting there saying, well, wait a minute. For a few months, the United States has your back, and then one day they just decide for domestic political needs they need to throw you under the bus. And so that's not very reassuring. If you're Hamas or Iran, you look at what's happening and you say, wait a minute, pressure's mounting on Israel. I mean, we know the U.S. was standing firmly by Israel for the first few months of this conflict, but now things may be changing. So why exactly should we go deeper on these hostage negotiations? So it gives them some encouragement because they think the pressure's mounting on Israel. And now the administration constantly is saying, day after, day after, day after, what's your day after plan? What's your day after plan? And you can't even have a conversation about a day after plan until Yahya Sinwar, the leader of Hamas in Gaza, decides it's over. He's losing. This is done. He's not going to emerge from the rubble of Gaza and live to fight another day. It is over. You can't even think about a day after plan till the leadership of Hamas recognizes that they are on the cusp, they're on the brink of a decisive loss, that they are over. And what happens at the UN, the message sent to the UN is, wait a minute, maybe we're not on the brink. Maybe we are going to emerge from the rubble. Maybe there will be a Hamas 2.0. I say to the administration, you want a day after plan? Drive this war to an end. How do you drive this war to an end? Let Israel win decisively. How do you slow that down? How do you stymie it? Give Hamas hope. And what happened at the UN gave Hamas hope. Now, is it irreversible? No. Like I said, I think Israel is going to go into Rafah. The administration knows Israel is going to go into Rafah. I think once they go into Rafah, I don't want to sound overly confident, but at least talking to Israelis who are very involved with this that I speak to, believe that they have learned a lot over the last few months about how to fight this war in Gaza, and they're getting much better at it. They've had some extraordinary successes. The event at the Shifa Hospital over the last 2 days is really extraordinary. And they believe once they go into Rafah, it will be ugly what happens in Rafah, but they think once they go into Rafah, they're really just a few weeks away from winding down this war. And so if they can get the administration to just back off and give them some space and let them do it, I think this war could actually wind down relatively quickly.
Well, you've talked about all the people he's sending signals to. He seems to be more concerned with sending a signal to Michigan than anything else. And he seems to be more concerned with sending a signal to 5% of the Michigan electorate specifically. We had Mark Penn on the podcast last month, and he's one of the best pollsters who asked one of the most interesting questions. And I was just looking at his most recent, his March Harvard-Harris poll. Almost 80% of Americans support Israel. 77% say Hamas should be removed from Gaza. 63% support a ceasefire only after Hamas is removed and all the hostages are returned. 66% believe that Israel is trying to avoid civilian casualties. He asked a new question this month, which I think is absolutely fascinating. He found 54% majority say Biden's decisions on the Israel-Hamas war are being directed by his domestic considerations, not what's best for Israel, the United States, and the world. That is a devastating political statistic for the president. The American people look at him and they don't see him focused on doing what's right, but doing what's politically expedient. That reeks of desperation. Desperation is politically unattractive. Courage is politically attractive. He was standing on the stage at that fundraiser, Radio City Music Hall, with Bill Clinton. Why didn't he take a page out of Bill Clinton's Sister Soldier playbook and turn to those people and say, you know something? Israel is not responsible for the civilian casualties in Gaza. Hamas is responsible for the civilian casualties. Hamas has to be destroyed, and we're going to stand with Israel until every single Hamas fighter is killed and the organization is destroyed. He would have gotten more political advantage from the majority of Michiganders who support Israel than by pandering to these terrorist sympathizers. What is the political calculation in the White House? They think that weakness and pandering is the way to win an election.
Well, there are two problems. One is the polling is really interesting to me on U.S. attitudes towards the war in Gaza, because I don't think it's just about standing with Israel. I think there's something else going on, which is I think the war with Hamas has brought to the surface some pretty crazy and scary elements in the United States, where we are literally seeing like pogroms on U.S. college campuses, and we are seeing pro-Hamas protesters shutting down bridges, shutting down, you know, protesting at hospitals, you know, wreaking
Saint
havoc.
St. Patrick's Cathedral on Easter.
There you go, St. Patrick's Cathedral. And we can go on and on and on. I mean, it's yeah. Incredible. At Vanderbilt University 2 days ago, they had to arrest. They suspended something like 20 students. They had to have arrested three of them. This is going on everywhere. It is out of control. It is really out of control. Jewish-owned businesses are being vandalized. That is like the most raw form of anti-Semitism, right? Because it's not like the owners of these businesses, that there's any evidence that they have any direct ties to the Israeli government or decision-making in the war. They are destroying property of Jews. That's what this is about. That is, I'm not being histrionic here, that was Kristallnacht, right? A friend of mine, Heather Reisman, who's the CEO of Indigo Books, which is like the Barnes & Noble of Canada, Jewish woman, her stores were brutally vandalized in Canada on the 85th anniversary of Kristallnacht. Like, destruction of Jewish property is the point. This is going on. Now, what is revealing in an encouraging way, this is obviously upsetting and disorienting to Jews, but also non-Jews. I can't tell you how many friends of mine who are not Jewish, who tell me, who have no connection to Israel, they're not involved with Israel, they don't really pay attention to Israel, they're not hostile to Israel, it's just not in there, it's not an issue they spend time thinking about. And they say, what is going on here? Like, the sort of breakdown in order, the lashing out at one minority group in the United States in the most violent and discriminatory way, people just feel like things are coming apart in the U.S. And I think that is why there is this rallying to Israel. It's not just that it's an ally. It's not just that we share values with this country. It's a sense that this war has triggered something in the United States that's not okay. And it's emblematic of something larger going on in society. And I think that's the opportunity for Biden. If Biden said, let me tell you why this is not okay. And then he could really lay it out. That is the ultimate sister soldier moment. To me, it is such a missed opportunity. The other point is the idea that they think politically, and that, like, again, obviously I'm not advising them on politics, but the Biden team, but they think that they can have it both ways is preposterous, that it is a zero-sum game, you know, that they think that they can, like, ding Israel a little bit, enough to win over, to mollify the pro-Hamas sympathizers in the Democratic Party, but not too much as to alienate the Jewish voters or people who are sympathetic to Israel. They will never be able to go far enough to mollify the pro-Hamas sympathizers in the Democratic base. They just won't. And anything they do on that dial will wind up alienating a lot of other voters. So in Michigan, you're right. There is some subset of the electorate that is sympathetic to Hamas. There's also a big Jewish community in Michigan, in the, you know, the Metro Detroit area, in places like Oakland County and Wayne County, or in Pennsylvania. Biden cannot get reelected without winning Pennsylvania. And Biden cannot win Pennsylvania without winning the Philly suburbs. And you can't win the Philly suburbs if you're a Democrat if some subset of the Jewish community starts to drop off. Who understands that? Who understands where a state like Pennsylvania is? John Fetterman, right? John Fetterman today, by the way, is his...
I love John Fetterman.
So do I. So do I.
I'm so sorry for everything I said about him.
I feel the same way.
I take it all back.
I feel the same. So the three issues John Fetterman is focused on, the three issues that have defined his first couple years in the Senate are... tough on immigration, tough on crime, unapologetically pro-Israel. Those are three winning issues for a Democrat. And he's polling way ahead of Biden in Pennsylvania today. And so I think that it's a mistake what the administration is doing. And it's a mistake on principle, and it's actually a mistake strategically in terms of politics.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I agree with Mark wholeheartedly about Fetterman. And it is, as you say, remarkable that he is polling so much better than Biden in Pennsylvania and doesn't figure this out. Maybe we can come back to that. But I want to ask you a little bit.
The difference is, Danny, Tim, and Jack, the difference is that Fetterman's brain cells are healing and he's becoming more conservative, whereas Biden's are degenerating. And so he's becoming less.
All right. And now for the neurological moment at our podcast.
Neuroscience brought to you by What the Hell.
Exactly. You heard it here first, folks. I want to come back to the question of Rafa. It's been weird to me. You follow this just as closely, if not more closely than I do. When I look at the strategic situation and the imperative of the war, right? And even at the most recent statement by the White House in the wake of a Zoom call between senior administration officials and senior Israeli officials from the security cabinet, what I see is everybody knows that Israel has to go into Rafah. Rafah is, it's not the last pocket, but it's the last major pocket of Hamas dead-enders. It is where Yahya Sinwar is, who's the head of Hamas in Gaza. It is where the hostages probably are at this point. And while we know some of the Hamas guys are filtering back into the north, and we see that wherever Israel moves out, they move back in, they're very much remnants. They're not big, strategic, operationally coherent parts of Hamas. So what I don't get is this obsessive attitude towards Rafah, as if it is somehow different than Khan Yunis, or it's somehow different than northern Gaza. Do you understand what's happening on the ground there?
Well, first of all, I just want to rewind a little bit. What you said, I just want to put a neon sign over it. You are exactly right that Israel, while there may be remnants of Hamas circulating around Gaza, what has been extraordinary about what the IDF has been able to accomplish is the systematic breakdown of the military structure of Hamas. We all tend to think, or have historically tended to think, of Hamas as like just this ragtag terror organization. It is a light infantry army. It is organized into 24 battalions. The battalions are each assigned a geographic area within Gaza. There's a real command structure. It is a sophisticated army with sophisticated capabilities that were mostly smuggled in via Egypt over the last 15 or so years. And so what Israel's been doing is systematically breaking down these battalions. That is to say, they're not killing or capturing every member of Hamas. So to your point, some of them will be out there causing trouble, but breaking down the structure, the governing structure, the military structure of this military organization is very important. That's what Israel's been doing. And it can't finish it until it goes into Rafah, because at least, so we're told, about four battalions and four of the most powerful battalions within the Hamas structure are there, and a bunch of hostages are probably there, and the leadership of Hamas, or at least Sinwar, is probably there. The reason the administration has gotten into his head that Rafah should be avoided, an IDF operation into Rafah should be avoided, is because the high concentration of Palestinian civilians there. There are about 1.3 million Palestinian civilians there. And the administration just can't fathom how Israel conducts this operation without there being a massive human catastrophe in Rafah. Now, I think the administration, with time, their tolerance for human suffering, human Palestinian civilian suffering, with time, their tolerance for it has gone down. And so now they're looking at Israel conducting this operation where 1.3 million civilians are, and they just don't understand how Israel is going to do it. And so what a lot of the back and forth between the war cabinet and the administration has been about how Israel is going to do it. And I don't think Israel is going to persuade the administration that they can do it without totally avoiding human suffering. They'll try to minimize it, but they can't obviously avoid it because it is Hamas's choice to fight behind civilians. It's not Israel's. Israel would much prefer the situation that you have, for instance, in southern Lebanon, where most of the civilian population now has gotten out of southern Lebanon, and Hezbollah is not keeping them there. I'm not giving Hezbollah credit here. I don't think they had a choice. But in Gaza, Hamas is choosing to fight its war behind civilians. So this is not Israel's fault. That's the tension about Rafah. The administration has, my understanding, having spoken to folks in Israel who've been involved in these deliberations with the administration, my sense is that the administration has come up with some ludicrous ideas for how Israel can remove the threat from Rafah without conducting a real ground operation. Israel does not believe that is possible, what the administration is laying out. They do think the ideas are ludicrous. And, you know, let's use these interesting technology capabilities to seal the border with Egypt so that, you know, we'll isolate Hamas and Rafah that way. And of course, after October 7th, the last thing the IDF wants to hear about is how it can use technology to seal borders. And so I think, Danny, what's happened is I think the administration thought they could convince Israel not to go into Rafah. And I think the war cabinet has convinced the administration that Israel is going into Rafah. In fact, they're going into Rafah even if the United States is outright opposed. And they've just made that very clear publicly. Ron Dermer was on my podcast. He went way. He just basically said, no matter what the U.S. says, we're going in. We have to. He quotes Benny Gantz, member of the war cabinet, who was in Washington 3 weeks ago. And he gave this very powerful metaphor. He said, this is like asking us not to go into Rafah. It's like asking a fire department that's trying to extinguish a fire from a house that's burning down to stop once only 80% of the flames are burnt out and then leave and hope that those 20% won't require them to have to come back. And that's what you're asking us to do by not going into Rafah. Again, it's not just Netanyahu. The administration wants to make this all about Netanyahu. This is Netanyahu's war. All of the security cabinet, all of them, feel that they lose this war without going into Rafah. Not going into Rafah is not an option. And the administration at this point, I don't want to say they've made their peace with it, but they realize there's no stopping it. And so now they're just trying to figure out how to work with Israel in a way that minimizes civilian casualties, which is a little offensive because there's no country that fights its wars more, as you guys know, with a focus on minimizing casualties than Israel. Like, Israel doesn't need lecturing and finger wagging from the Americans about the importance of fighting wars that minimize civilian casualties.
And as Mark Penn points out, Americans understand that for the most part. But I think just people don't realize, you know, when you say the unity government, this would be as if after 9/11, George Bush had invited Al Gore and John Kerry and Nancy Pelosi into his government and they were making decisions collectively. It's kind of unprecedented what's happening.
It's unbelievable. I cannot tell you. I completely agree with you, Mark, that people don't understand this. I mean, I was asked the other day by someone, you know, what would be the impact on the war if Netanyahu were not in office? And I'm not here to give this is not a blanket defense of Netanyahu. It's beside the point. I said nothing would change. In fact, I could make the argument that of the war cabinet members, Netanyahu is the most cautious. In other words, Gallant, if you listen to what Gallant wants to do, Gallant wanted to wage a preemptive strike against southern Lebanon, against Hezbollah in the early days after October 7th. So Israel would have been in a two-front war from day one. I'm not saying that was a good idea or a bad idea. I'm just saying, you know, Benny Gantz is where Netanyahu is on how to fight this war, if not to the right of him. And obviously, Gantz and Netanyahu hate each other personally. They are political rivals. They literally, the animus between these two men. And yet, they're completely aligned on the policy of the war. And the way this war cabinet was structured is there's several observers in the war cabinet, but there are three people who have votes, which are Netanyahu, Yoav Gallant, who's the defense minister, and Benny Gantz, who's the leader of a rival political party to Netanyahu's party. No major decisions about the war cannot be made without a vote of those three men. It's not just Netanyahu. There's no commander-in-chief in Israel. It's just not how it's organized. And so the idea that this is all up to Netanyahu and that this is Netanyahu's war is just absurd. It's a very diverse group of thinkers who happen to have total alignment, more or less, on what needs to be done in this war.
So I've just been watching Masters of the Air on Apple TV, which is this new Spielberg series about the air war in Europe. And, you know, I just can't imagine what the decisions would have been if Joe Biden was in charge of deciding whether we bomb Berlin. You know, the civilian devastation that took place there, it was just, the war is terrible. And you point out that Hamas hiding behind civilians. It's interesting that if you look at Ukraine right now, what you have is their air defenses get weaker and they start bombing cities, getting these weapons through. The civilians are in the tunnels, in the subways, and the fighters are up top taking the casualties. In Gaza, it's the opposite. It's the Hamas fighters who are hiding in the tunnels and they're using the civilians as human shields to deter the U.S. from supporting Israel in taking them out.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't understand why this administration doesn't explain that to people, that all the civilian casualties are Hamas's fault. They are literally taking civilians and putting them in the way to deter Israel from destroying them, like a bunch of cowards.
Yeah. So there are two thinkers on this issue that I encourage your listeners to seek out. One of them is John Spencer, who's the head of urban warfare at West Point, who's one of the foremost authorities on the history of urban warfare. And he basically says that he has never seen a military have to fight the kind of war or the urban warfare war that Israel is fighting. It's not like the U.S.-led coalition fighting ISIS in Mosul. I mean, he just goes through the history. There's nothing quite like it because he can't think of another military that has had to fight an enemy that has developed the tunnel system like Hamas has done in Gaza, 300-plus miles of tunnels. It's the equivalent of like the tube system in the U.K., but bigger, super complex, very deep. And that the
let me correct you, Dan. We built it for them.
Right. Well, yeah. Fair enough.
We gave them the money and all the, fair enough. You know, this is a Western technological
achievement. Right. You're the U.S. taxpayer.
So Israel is having to fight this, as you say, with the combatants underground, not the innocents. So that's the first point. The second point is, even with that challenge, when people say the civilian death toll is too high. Now, obviously, any innocent death is one too many. It goes without saying. But when people throw this rhetoric around, I say, compared to what? When you say it's too high, what's your benchmark? Of course, they never have one. I said, what's your benchmark? I said, so I just recorded an episode on my podcast, which will drop in a few days, with this guy, Abraham Widener, who's the data science professor at Wharton, who did this very interesting essay analyzing, he wrote it for Tablet Magazine, analyzing the casualty count numbers, and basically shows that the numbers provided by the Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry are completely, like, they don't make any sense. Like, if you actually drill down, and he walks through how the numbers are just, the idea that the media and others have...
everybody uses them.
Like, it's just basic arithmetic, they don't make sense. But even if you take them at their word, it means that the ratio of civilians to combatants killed are about 1.4, 1.5 to 1. So for every Hamas terrorist killed, you have 1 to 1.5 civilians killed, which you talk to any military historian, by any standard, like certainly these, as you said, Mark, these decisions about bombing Berlin, it's like extremely low. There's no, you'd be very hard in any warlike situation to find a number that low on the civilian front. So people just throw, the civilian death toll is too high. Of course, it's tragic, but it's actually not high. If you're trying to have an honest comparison to historical precedents, A, and B, if you want to discuss civilian casualties, to your point, who's responsible for the civilian casualties? There's only one party to this war that targets civilians on the Israeli side and basically targets civilian casualties on their own side because they use their own side, the civilians on their own side, as shields.
What you're talking about in your conversation with the Wharton professor is super interesting because I wrote a piece for National Review about these numbers. For me, there were a couple of different things that were absolutely fascinating. One was that the Biden administration started out and the president himself said, I don't believe these numbers. We're never going to use these numbers that all come from Hamas that are lies. I'm paraphrasing. It was pretty bold. And then in the State of the Union, he actually uses the Hamas numbers. But what's amazing about this is, even if you use the Hamas numbers, which bear no relationship at all to any reality, and there have been increasing numbers of people who now admit that, even if you use those numbers, the ratio of the civilian to the military deaths in Gaza has been not just low, but almost unprecedentedly low. As you say, even if it's in the range of about 1.5, where you're talking about, you know, half as many civilians killed as terrorists, the United Nations claims, and I think, again, it's like so much of what the United Nations says, but the United Nations claims that in war, the standard ratio is 9 to 1. Now, I think that's garbage, right? But still, even by those own standards, Israelis are doing incredibly well. Okay, that was just my little footnote of a rant for you about this.
It's a rant I agree with. And I also want to say, you're exactly right about, I was outraged at the State of the Union, where the administration had resisted using the Gaza Health Ministry numbers as a reliable source for the longest time. And I will tell you, at a practical level, I spent a lot of time talking to journalists who are trying to get educated about the war, and journalists who are not rah-rah pro-Israel, but they don't wake up hostile to Israel. They're sort of on the fence trying to understand this conflict. They know it's complicated, some of them, and they're educatable. And the number of them that told me that when the administration early on made it clear that they would not recognize the Gaza Health Ministry numbers, that the Gaza Health Ministry was basically a propaganda arm of Hamas, it forced the editorial decision-making within these media organizations to do the same, because they're like, well, if the administration is saying that they don't give any credence to these numbers, how can we? So they would, you'd notice early on, the most media organizations, even ones that were very critical of Israel in the U.S., were still qualifying the use of the Gaza Health Ministry numbers because the administration had put down that marker so clearly. The moment President Biden stopped doing it, first you had a week before the State of the Union where Secretary Austin did it, but then at least the Pentagon corrected it. But then when President Biden did it without qualifying it, that sends confusing signals. It sends confusing signals to everybody.
No, absolutely. So this is my exit question. I could talk to you forever. And we do agree about a lot of this, which makes it so much easier. But I want to talk about Qatar, because I am continually amazed how the Qatari regime, which funds Hamas directly, which is a home to Hamas leadership, as well as Al-Qaeda leadership, as well as the Taliban leadership, as well as every other terrorist group known to man, and funds them and supports them and lets them hide the money that they stole, in the case of Hamas, from the Palestinian people and international donors in their
Hamas.
Hamas, right.
No, from us. Stole from us.
Yeah, stole from us.
Taxpayers.
Yeah, stole from the U.S. taxpayer. It is incredible to me that we still are comfortable having an airbase there, that we still treat them as if they are not hostile to the United States. Al Jazeera is the propaganda arm for Islamist extremists. Why is this, do you think? And why do those of us who make this argument, why are we getting so little traction? I want to put one little asterisk on that as well for you, which is when you look at the funding for organizations like Student for Justice in Palestine and other extremist, pro-Hamas, terrorist, anti-Semitic organizations in the United States, especially at the university level, a lot of that money is coming from Qatar as well. Why are we not gaining ground here?
I think the Qatar dynamic is really complex for a number of reasons. I think may partially answer your question, not the least of which is the Israelis and the Americans, and I hate to say what I'm about to say, but the Israelis and the Americans, for the longest time, were on board with this arrangement. And I know it. I know it. I've spoken to Israeli officials who were involved in cultivating the relationship. Administrations of both parties for a couple of decades have been part of this arrangement. And the theory was, let's just take the Hamas piece, because I know less about, it is true that they have all these bad actors, the Taliban there, and they have relationships with Tehran and Turkey and a lot of other, you know, problematic countries for the United States. But as it relates to Hamas, as short-sighted as it may have been, there was this general understanding that it was in the U.S. and Israel's interest to at least have their eyes on some entity that communicates with Hamas, which is this Khaled Meshaal and Ismail Haniyeh, who run the non-Gaza-based part of Hamas. So they run it out of Doha. And it's better that they have eyes on those folks and access to them indirectly rather than them disappearing and, you know, going to set up their offices in somewhere like Beirut or Tehran or Istanbul. Better they have it in a place where there's a U.S. military base, there's a lot of U.S. surveillance and U.K. surveillance, and they could have that channel. Again, we can say it's misguided, we can say, but everyone was on board with it. The U.S. was on board with it, and I hate to say it, Israel was on board with it. Now, from Doha's standpoint, I often think about their situation. Is it ideological or is it survivalist? So they definitely feel under threat in the region. The 2017 blockade by the other Gulf states of Qatar, the sense that they share gas fields with Iran effectively. I mean, they're right next to Iran. That they're a tiny country with a tiny population, something like only 200,000 citizens, actual citizens. Most of the population are foreign nationals. They could be wiped at any moment. They just kind of want to be Switzerland. It's a survivalist strategy. Or do you believe it's ideological, where they're like ideologically committed to all these causes? Hamas, Islamic Brotherhood, Taliban. I tend to think it's the former. I tend to think it's more survivalist. I don't know, though. And we'll learn a lot, I think, after this war, because I think Qatar's going to have to make some decisions. I think that the tolerance for the relationship with Hamas, or the sense that it's in U.S. and Israel's interest for them to have this channel to a Hamas affiliate in Doha it's not working out exactly as I think Jerusalem and Washington had thought it would. And then the question is, if it's not ideological, could it be like, I mean, a number of folks who are wrestling with this issue that I talk to American policymakers is they say, well, wait a minute, not people who are political appointees, just kind of people who are generally like in the system in the Pentagon and elsewhere. They say, could this be like the Saudis after 9/11? where the Saudis flipped and over a decade or decade and a half after 9/11 went through this modernizing period, and where they stopped funding the crazy Wahhabism, and they stopped funding these madrasas in Saudi Arabia and around the world and these mosques, and stopped exporting this hate, and they tried to actually modernize. Could Qatar go to the same path? That is, their strategy been purely survivalist, but now it's backfiring? I don't know the answer to this question. I'm more of an observer on it than directly involved in any way, but I'm curious what you guys think. Could they go the way of Saudi if they realize it's becoming more of a liability for them than an asset?
I mean, my answer to that is no, for very simple reasons. They have created a culture around these ideas that is self-fulfilling. So, you know, the come to Jesus moment, if I can use a weird expression for the Saudis.
Biden used it with Netanyahu.
Right. For them was 9/11, right? Because they had been funding all of these groups. I think the problem with the Qataris is that their playing both sides has become almost doctrinal. And they've also educated their population. And that for them is very important too, because as you know, none of these populations are that stable. And so they've done that. But I mean, they've been complicit in the murder of American citizens. They've been complicit in the murder of US troops. Al Jazeera has helped. And by the way, the Israelis say Al Jazeera also is helping Hamas on the ground inside Israel. So the other problem, Dan, of course, is that nobody has actually come to them and said, okay, now is your fatal moment of choice. You know, are you, to quote George Bush, right? Are you with us or are you against us? They allow them to play both sides, and that's another big problem. But this is another something for us to solve.
Well, there's a story, by the way, that after, again, we'll learn a lot in the next, months and years. But there is this story that right after October 7th, the Qatar leadership asked Blinken, should we remove Hamas from Doha? And Blinken said, no, we'd rather keep them here and keep people have this channel. Again, we could say it's misguided, but to your point, people have allowed them to.
Right.
All right. Well, exit question from me. I mean, one of the problems we have here that is with the Biden administration is they don't seem to believe in victory. You know, you see this in Ukraine, where they give the Ukrainians just enough weapons to hold off the Russians, but not the weapons they need to actually retake the territory that the Russians have taken. And yes, Israel can defend itself, but you have to put civilian casualties ahead of victory. But also, we want it to end as quickly as possible. Here's the thing, though. It's not going to end after Rafah. Because Hezbollah is next, right? It's not a question of whether they go after Hezbollah. It's a question of whether it's sequential or simultaneous. They'd prefer it, I think, to be sequential. But what's going to happen to the Biden administration's support and international support when the war with Hezbollah really takes off?
I was with Yossi Klein Halevi, who's an interesting thinker in Jerusalem, public intellectual. He was in New York last week. I was recording a podcast with him. And we were leaving the studio and we were walking. And he was talking about this press statement that Netanyahu had given at a cabinet meeting shortly before that, where he said, the world has already forgotten what happened to us on October 7th. And he kind of reminded, he was trying to remind listeners what had happened to Israel on October 7th. And Yossi's complaint was, he agreed with everything Netanyahu said, which is rare these days because he's a big critic of Netanyahu, but he said, I agreed with everything Netanyahu said, but he says, I want him to stop saying what happened to us, because the threat that Hamas poses is much bigger than to us, to Israel. That if Hamas survives, the threat it poses to the West, the impact is civilizational. If an entity like Hamas can do what it did on October 7th and still be standing, we need to start talking about the impact of Hamas's survival after October 7th for everyone who cares about freedom and normalcy and individual liberties and Western civilization. And it'd be wonderful if the Biden administration talked about it too in those terms, because it has impact. It's not just about those poor Jews in Israel who suffered. It has much bigger implications, and it'd be important if the Biden administration talked in those terms. As for Israel going into the North, I do think it's just a matter of time, but I do not think it's near term. Look, I think that there's some interesting targets of opportunity, like what we saw over the last few days with Israel. It appears to be Israel having struck this diplomatic facility, the Iranian diplomatic facility in Damascus, and taking out a senior IRGC.
Diplomatic facility, diplomatic, air quotes, right?
Yes. Well, they can't see us. They can't see you doing the air quotes. They can only hear us. But yes, assumed air quotes. So I think Israel is going to get more aggressive about taking out officials tied to Hezbollah or people supporting Hezbollah. But I don't think they're in a rush to go to war against Hezbollah for a variety of reasons. One, they do have to finish off Rafah, and that's going to take some time, finish off Hamas, and I don't think they want to be in a two-front war. B, they're having a hard enough time with the administration dealing with finishing this war with Rafah, I think the last thing they want to do now is inject into their dialogue with the administration the possibility of a northern front and what that would entail. I don't have a crystal ball here, but I would be surprised if Israel, on the one hand, they're preparing for war. They're definitely preparing for war in the north, but I would be surprised if it happens really soon. I think it's most likely, and I'm a minority on this, I think it would be unlikely to happen before the U.S. presidential election, just for purposes of making sure they have the administration on side, finishing off its war with Hamas. I think making a commitment that they won't open the next front before the election. Now, obviously, it's a dynamic situation, and Israel could say we have no choice, and Hezbollah is getting more aggressive, and we've got to deal with them now. They, you know, like I said, it's dynamic, and things can spiral out of control, but I don't believe Israel's in a rush. They're preparing for war with Hezbollah, but they're not in a rush to fight a war with Hezbollah.
I lied because you mentioned the presidential election, so I have a follow-up question. So we just had these Israeli journalists who met with Donald Trump and Mar-a-Lago and came away, according to Jonathan Swan, our friend at the New York Times, very troubled meeting. And basically Trump said, you got to finish up this war. You got to get it done. We have to get to peace. We can't have this thing going on. What's the Trump administration going to think? I think Trump would have a strategy for victory in a sense. He wants to get it done by Israel just wiping out Hamas and taking the gloves off and finishing it so we can get this done. But how is the Trump administration going to see this, particularly with the next phase with Hezbollah?
So I have no idea what Trump really thinks about this war.
Neither does he.
I know. I get asked this all the time. What would Trump do? I mean, I say, first of all, look, what we can say is based on how his administration conducted policy vis-a-vis Israel, he would be very supportive. And I think their legacy and record speaks for itself. But I mean, who knows? I mean, that I can't put that much stock in it. I thought it was an odd formulation, what he said, which is just wrap it up, basically. Now, he didn't say Israel's got to rein in what it's doing. He wasn't saying, don't do this, do this. So he wasn't like putting constraints on Israel like the administration is doing. So when I've pressed folks close to his world, I say, what was that interview? This is the Israel Hayom, the Israeli newspaper that you're referring to. When I say, what was he thinking with this? This is concerning. They're like, well, keep in mind, he just thinks it's in everyone's interest for this to wind down, but he's not telling Israel how to fight the war, which is much better than the Biden administration. Mark, who the hell knows? I mean, to try to understand what is going on in his head and around him on this issue, I will speak with confidence about things I know. This is one I have no idea because, as Danny said, like, you know, he may not even know.
Yay, election year. Can't wait for the next day, every single day of this year. At least we didn't have to talk about RFK.
Yes.
you were as great as expected and even better. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us. Keep doing a great job on your own podcast. We love it.
Thank you so much, guys. I really, like I said, I'm huge fans of WTH. So it was a real treat to join you. And let's do it again.
And everybody, if you love this interview, tune into Dad's podcast. Tell everyone where they can find your pod.
Call Me Back is the name of the podcast. You can find it wherever you find it, on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. We appreciate it.
All right, guys. Thank you.
Take care. Thanks, Dan.
Sure. Danny, what do you think the Trump policy on Israel is going to be?
You know, like I said, I don't think he knows. I've talked to a bunch of people who are wondering. In fact, a good friend of ours, I won't mention her name, but who just went off on a visit to Israel. And she said, people keep asking her, what's Donald Trump's policy? What's Donald Trump's policy? She said, I can't even find someone who works for Donald Trump, who handles foreign policy, who knows what his policy is. But that interview with Israel Hayom is really not heartening, and it suggests that as capricious as he has been historically, he is now even more ridiculous. He's mad about the fact that Bibi Netanyahu congratulated Joe Biden on his election victory. I mean, what the hell?
Well, I read that interview slightly differently.
Of course you did.
Having interviewed Trump and engaged with him a great deal in the past, there's a tendency for everyone to take Trump's pronouncements and pose the worst possible reading on them and go and then start setting their hair on fire. And I think that's not what he was saying. I think the difference between Biden and Trump on Israel is that Trump would not be telling Israel to focus on avoiding civilian casualties. He would be telling Israel to focus on winning and winning as quickly as possible. If you look at what he did in the campaign against ISIS, he inherited that from the Obama administration. The Obama administration put all sorts of restraints on what our military commanders could do against ISIS, and he basically told them to take the gloves off and just kick the living shit out of them, and effectively did that and wrapped it up fairly quickly. And I think that's what he means, that Israel's got to end this. Go in, do what you have to do, and win the war. The question will be what happens when they say, okay, and now we're going after Hezbollah. What will Trump do there? The concern I would have, and I think that many of us have, is that the problem with the second Trump administration's policy towards Israel and other places might not necessarily be Donald Trump. It might be the people who he surrounds himself with, because we always look at the success, the foreign policy successes of the first Trump administration, which I am much more supportive of and admiring of than you are. But they were enormous successes in the first Trump administration. But that was because Donald Trump surrounded himself with a team of rivals, including people who disagreed with him on foreign policy, people who had long experience in foreign policy, people like our friend Steve Biegun, people like Mike Pompeo, Gina Haspel at CIA. I can go on and name a lot of the people who we liked who were in the Trump administration, Matt Pottinger, who were making these decisions. I don't know that those are the people who are going to be staffing a second Trump administration. I'm more worried that it's going to be the J.D. Vances of the world and people with their worldview who will be there. I think it's to his credit that he brought in lots of people with differing political views and made decisions after hearing different kinds of advice. I worry that there's going to be a monotone of isolationists whispering in his ear in the second term, and that worries me much more than what Trump's instincts would be. I think Trump's instincts is he doesn't like wars, he doesn't want us to get dragged into them, but when it comes to Israel, like, just do it, finish it, get it done, kick their ass, and then end it. I hope that's what he means.
Yes. Well, I think your beliefs are a triumph of hope over experience, but
they're actually a triumph of experience over hope, because that's what he would have done in the first Trump term.
No relationship between the Trump pre-January 6th, pre-2020 election and the Trump today.
That's the big question everybody's wrestling with right now, isn't it?
Well, I've decided. So that's
I know.
There's the news alert for the day, folks. Hey, what have you decided? Let us know what you think. Let us know whether you like the podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to our Substack. Don't forget to share everything with your friends. And don't forget to send us criticisms of Mark, as usual.
And if you've gotten this far, we think you like the podcast. So tell everybody about it and spread the word.
Take care, folks.
See you next week. Let us know what topics you'd like us to cover. You can get in touch with the show by emailing us at whatthehell@aei.org.
Or you can reach us on Twitter. I'm at D. Pletka.
And I'm at Mark Thiessen. That's Mark with a C.
Please rate and review the podcast. If you like the show, please subscribe, share it, comment on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you're listening to this.
Thanks for listening.